microphone 4. Sound check, microphone 3. And test fire 1. Sound check, test fire 2. And test fire 3.
call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 2nd, 2020, and the time is 2:37. Members present, Representative Laban, Representative Tilton, Vice Chair Ortiz, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Merrick, and myself, Representative Johnston. On today's agenda, we have House Bill 127 by Representative Sponholz, House Bill 159 by Representative Price Tompkins, and House Bill 185 by Representative Tarr. My intention is to introduce these bills and set them aside. Are there any questions? Representative Laban?
Just a clarification, Madam Co-Chair. It's House Bill 182. Or is
House
it?
House Bill 185. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. You're right. 182. I'm reading my notes. Can't read my writing. Thank you. And we've been joined by Representative Wohl. First up, I'd like to bring House Bill 127, an act relating to the practice of dental hygiene, establishing an advanced practice permit, prohibiting unfair discrimination under group health insurance against dental hygienists who hold an advanced permit, practice permit relating to medical assistance for dental hygiene services, and providing for an effective date for the committee. To begin with, I'd like to invite, and glad to see you're here, Representative Sponholz and her staff, Casey Kasort, to the table. And please put yourselves on the record and begin your bill and PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm Representative Ivy Sponholz, representing District 16 in Anchorage. Thank you for hearing House Bill 127 today, establishing advanced practice permits for dental hygienists. So oral health plays a really critical role in overall health and well-being for Alaskans. Poor oral health contributes to poor physical health overall. This is a big problem among some of our state's most vulnerable populations. 62% of elementary students have tooth decay, low-income individuals and families that don't regularly seek oral health care due to cost, apprehension of dental care, access, and trouble finding a provider can contribute to bad health outcomes related to cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis, poor nutrition, and other serious health consequences. So HB 127 aims to increase access to oral health care to underserved populations, specifically children, seniors, and individuals with disabilities. HB 127 creates an advanced practice permit for dental hygienists, similar to advanced nurse practitioners have. That was created in 1981 and has been in practice and been in implementation since 1984. Currently, dental hygienists can practice in a dentist practice or practice semi-independently if they have a collaborative agreement with a dentist, which is similar to what physician's assistants do. HB 127 creates an advanced practice permit, which allows dental hygienists to care for underserved populations in senior centers, healthcare facilities, daycares, schools, and for Alaskans who are eligible for public assistance, are homebound, or live in an underserved community. The permit would allow dental hygienists who have a minimum of 4,000 hours of clinical experience and who are approved by the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners to be advanced practice dental hygienists. The bill lays out very specific services allowed within the permit and the specific populations that licensed dental hygienists can provide services to without supervision or the physical presence of a licensed dentist. This is not a carte blanche to practice independently. This is in very specific, discrete circumstances. This list has been developed in consultation with the Alaska Dental Society, the Board of Dental Examiners, and the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. Advanced practice dental hygienists will have to maintain malpractice insurance, provide a written notice of their service limitations, and make a referral to a licensed dentist nearby if further dental treatment is needed. It'll allow dental hygienists to practice the full scope of their training, credentials, and professional experience. It's important to note that Alaska wouldn't be the first state to make these changes. Dental hygienists are able to practice under advanced practice permits or similar permits in six other states: Colorado, Washington, Montana, Maine, Connecticut, and California. And 40 other states are considered direct access states. That means that dental hygienists can initiate treatment based on their assessment of the patient's need without authorization or presence of a dentist. So we are not breaking new trail here. We're doing something that's been done in many, many other states. Lastly, I'll note that since last year, we've made some important changes to the bill at the recommendation of the Board of Dental Examiners and the Alaska Dental Association, including requiring permit holders to maintain patient records for at least 7 years, making sure that the Board of Dental Examiners has separately certified a dental hygienist to administer anesthesia, and empowering DHSS to make regulations related to the bill. My aide, Casey Kasort, who's actually a University of Alaska intern this year, has a presentation, and on the line we have Katrina Virgin, president of the Alaska Dental Hygienist Association, on the phone, and then I believe that David Nielsen, chair of the dental board, is also planning to be available.
Thank you, and we've been joined by co-chair Foster and Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, co-chair Johnston and co-chair Foster and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Casey Kasort, and I'm an intern with Representative Sponholz. I'm hoping to talk today about purpose of House Bill 127 and go through the sectional analysis. I know we're on a schedule, so I'll try to move quickly, but please stop me if you have any questions. As many of you probably already know, there are many unique barriers to accessing health care, including dental care, in Alaska. As Rep. Sponholz mentioned, 62% of Alaskan elementary students have a high rate of tooth decay, and 43% of low-income Alaskans have trouble biting or chewing. Both young adults and low-income adults across America cite pain as their top oral health problem, and low-income families in Alaska don't regularly seek oral health care due to cost, access, or trouble finding a provider. We need all of our qualified health professionals operating to the full scope of their training, especially when it comes to caring for Alaskans with the greatest need. Dental hygienists are state-licensed health professionals who've been trained to provide education and care that focuses on preventing and treating oral diseases. However, under current statute, dental hygienists must work under the direct supervision of a licensed dentist or enter a collaborative agreement where they remain under general supervision. This limits where and when dental hygienists can practice and is a barrier to preventative dental care for our seniors, children, and Alaskans living with disabilities. HB 127 creates an advanced practice permit that allows experienced licensed dental hygienists to work independently to the full scope of their training, credentials, and professional experience when they are providing care to underserved populations. So underserved populations are defined in U.S. code under the term dental health shortage areas, which are geographic areas, populations, and facilities with too few dental providers and services. In Alaska, this means an area with more than 5,000 patients per one provider. And dental health shortage areas in Alaska that an advanced practice permit holder could serve include geographic areas like the North Slope Borough, facilities which primarily serve tribal populations like Mount Edgecombe Hospital or Chief Andrew Isaac Health Center, correctional centers like Goose Creek Correctional, and federally qualified health centers like the Bethel Family Clinic or Matsu Health Services. HB 127 allows hygienists to care for Alaskans in need, like elders living in senior centers, underserved children in schools, Alaskans who are eligible for public assistance, and Alaskans with disabilities for whom oral care can be a scary, uncomfortable experience. Increasing the number of underserved Alaskans receiving preventative care also means that dental hygienists can catch more acute problems earlier on when care is less costly, painful, and inconvenient. HB 127 is the next step in allowing dental hygienists to provide preventative care to patients with the greatest needs. Now, I'd like to walk through the bill section by section, and please stop me again if you have any questions. Section 1 amends the dental hygienist scope of practice to allow advanced practice permit holders to provide specific services independently. Section 2A allows the State of Alaska Board of Dental Examiners to issue advanced practice permits to hygienists with at least 4,000 hours of clinical experience. Section 2B enumerates the services an advanced practice permit holder can perform without the presence, authorization, supervision, or prior examination of a licensed dentist, including providing oral health education, removing stains and deposits from the surfaces of the teeth, applying preventative agents and sealants, taking and developing x-rays, screening for oral cancer, using local anesthesia if separately licensed to do so by the board, and performing preliminary charting and triage to formulate a dental hygiene assessment and dental hygiene treatment plan. Section 2D requires an advanced practice permit holder to maintain liability insurance and provides their patients and requires them to provide their patient or patient's parent or legal guardian with written notice of the services the permit allows them to perform. They must also help these patients with referrals to see licensed dentists for more comprehensive dental care. Section 2E allows an advanced practice permit holder to practice as an independent contractor. Section 2F establishes that the advanced practice permit is valid until the dental hygienist license expires and allows the permit to be renewed at the same time as the license. Section 3 amends the grounds for discipline, suspension, or revocation of a dental hygienist license to allow them to provide the services listed in Section 2 independently without being punished. Section 3 also empowers the board to discipline permit holders who allow a dental assistant under their supervision to practice outside of their scope of practice, if they falsify or destroy a patient or facility record, or if they fail to maintain a patient or facility record for at least 7 years, which is similar to the requirement for dentists and was an amendment that was added in the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Section 4 amends Alaska Statute 08-36-346, Delegation to Dental Assistants, to allow permit holders to delegate x-rays, application of topical preventative agents or sealants, and other tasks specified by the Board of Dental Examiners in regulation to dental assistants under their supervision. The board is also tasked with specifying in regulation the levels of supervision required over dental assistants. Section 5 adds dental hygienists holding an advanced practice permit to the list of providers who may not be discriminated against. This prevents an insurer from refusing to reimburse the appropriately licensed provider on the basis of cost or on the basis of race, gender, etc. Section 6 adds dental hygiene services to the list of services which may be provided by the Department of Health and Social Services. And Section 7 allows the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, the Department of Health and Social Services, and the Board of Dental Examiners to adopt regulations necessary to implement the changes made in this bill. Finally, Sections 8 and 9 set an effective date of July 1st, 2020. That concludes the sectional analysis. And as we mentioned earlier, Katrina Virgin, president of the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association, should be on the line, as well as a few others, to answer questions.
Are there any questions? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Could you give me a little bit of information with regard to the educational requirements for a dental hygienist? And the reason I'm asking is I'm seeing that there is a correlation between a nurse practitioner in the sense of duties and then also an advanced practice dental hygienist. And I'm just trying to find a comparison then with regard to both education requirements.
I think for each. Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, I think it might be best if we ask Katrina Virgin to answer the question about education.
Ms. Virgin, did you hear the question?
Yes, ma'am, I have heard the question. And to answer that question, the requirements for a dental hygienist to become licensed in any state within, you know, the lower 48 and here in Alaska, they must have graduated from an accredited dental hygiene school. That's a CODA accreditation. And that school typically is 4 years. There are some programs still in existence that are 2 years. But if you noticed, even UAA here in Alaska has moved to a four-year bachelorette type program. And then in consideration to the 4,000 clinical hours that were previously discussed, that would have a hygienist who has been practicing consecutively about 3 to 4 years to obtain those 4,000 clinical hours. And of course, as it stated, that would be under a supervision of a dentist.
And Ms. Virgin, could you put your name on the record too, please?
Oh, yes, I apologize. For the record, my name is Katrina, last name Virgin.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Just to kind of finish my answer for my question was also just the comparison with a nurse practitioner versus the...
So Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, this is Representative Sponholz, and a nurse practitioner has more training than does a dental hygienist, but a nurse practitioner also has more authority. Nurse practitioners in the state of Alaska, for example, have full prescriptive authority, whereas a dental hygienist would not. So, you know, it appears that the training for a dental hygienist is in line with the services that they would be providing.
Follow-up?
How many years of training for a nurse practitioner versus this particular dental hygienist?
Representative Sutherland Leonard, through the chair. Nurse practitioner will have a four-year undergraduate degree and either a two- or four-year graduate degree as well.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Telton.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Would these services be able to be billed to Medicaid, and would it create a new category in Medicaid, and do we have an idea of what we may be looking at it as a would it an increase or a decrease in the Medicaid services overall?
Representative Tilton, through the chair, these dental hygienists would be able to bill Medicaid. Currently, they already do. They just do it through under the supervision of a dentist or through supervision of a dentist as a part of a collaborative agreement. This would allow them to practice independently. It is theoretically possible that you could see a larger number of, you know, people receiving services, but it's not really clear that that would be true because we wouldn't actually be changing eligibility or the number of services that are available. We also wouldn't be changing the number of people that are eligible for Medicaid in the state of Alaska. So you have a finite number of people that are eligible for Medicaid, a finite number of services that could be provided. What we're doing, we think, is actually making it sort of easier and more cost-effective for people to be able to get the preventative care that dental hygienists provide as opposed to more of the treatment options that dentists provide. We often say that we're going to the dentist when we're going to get our teeth cared for, but most of the time when we go to that place that we say is the dentist, we're really seeing a dental hygienist who is doing the routine cleaning and prophylactic sort of treatments that prevent us from needing, you know, cavities and, or, you know, treatment for cavities and other kinds of more expensive care.
Follow up.
I'm just kind of building this question in my head right now, but just wondering if we already have some challenges with preventative dental, do we feel confident that allowing a new category of advanced, I'm sorry, what you're calling them, advanced practice hygienists, do you think that would make people feel more comfortable about getting their preventative dental done if we're already having challenges with people getting preventative dental?
Representative Tilton, I think that's a really good question. Part of the way that this proposal is structured is that it allows people to get care in the place where they live or where they already are, and so they might be able to avoid having to go to to an office to get dental care, and they might be able to have somebody come on site to the nursing home, to the daycare center, to the elementary school, to the senior center, places that they're already very comfortable going to get the kind of care that they need. And we think that that would reduce the barrier to getting some of the preventative care. It also will, you know, increase access for people who are physically sometimes challenged in going to the dentist's office. If you are, for example, in a long-term care facility or a nursing facility, it's very difficult to get your body to, you know, a dental office in order to get your screening and cleaning, whereas if you can have the dental hygienist come visit you in your room and do that preventative care, you're more likely to get that care.
Representative Carpenter.
I'll pass for a minute.
Representative Foster.
Thank you. Have you had a chance to reach out to any of the hospitals in some of these areas where there are shortages, Ugyavik, Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel, and just have you had any feedback from any of the folks in these rural areas?
Representative or Co-Chair Foster, we actually haven't had any feedback from providers or hospitals in those areas. It's my guess that they would view this very favorably because it would be able to increase access to care. We know that there has been huge challenges with getting access to dental care in rural Alaska that actually precipitated the creation of the dental health aid therapists, which do amazing work in rural Alaska and have dramatically increased access to dental care. But this would be adding another level of possible, you know, provider of care in rural Alaska. And dental hygienists obviously will be more affordable than will dentists because they have a lot fewer, university bills to pay off.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In order for Representative Sponholz, in order for a person, a dental hygienist, to receive an advanced practice permit, they could only do so in the areas of what's, quote, underserved areas. Mm-hmm. My question is, I see this as an illustration of some of those underserved areas, and then it says full index of all dental professional shortage areas here. So how much more extensive is that list? Can you tell me about that?
Maybe what page we're going to.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, that list is quite extensive. I'm happy to get that to you through the I'll send it to your committee aide, and it does include many facilities across Alaska, but they are often targeting specifically underserved populations. And I can also give you the information for how they calculate that, which does factor in the patient-to-provider ratio, as well as whether or not their water is fluoridated, and whether or not, like, how long it takes to access the dentist. So those are the factors that go into a score, which is between 0 and 26, and that's how they rank them, and they go back and revisit those classifications. But I'll be happy to get you all of them.
Thanks.
Representative Telton.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Is this an appropriate time to talk about the fiscal note, or shall we wait till?
Actually, we can. I was actually thinking that we would wait till later discussion on the fiscal note.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a couple questions related to this list, as Representative Ortiz did. There's a definition of underserved populations, but then I have a letter, for example, in my packet from Mary Cerny from Fairbanks, mm-hmm. and there's a line that says this bill would eliminate some barriers to access that are obstacles to care that is desperately needed by many. And in the paragraph above, it talks about dental insurance and how it's mostly just a copay plan. So it seems to me the barrier to access for some people is simply they can't afford it. Does this, by allowing more hygienists to be a
advanced practice.
Thank you. I was looking for the phrase advanced practice hygienist. Would it give them access to say low income people just on the basis of being low income, as opposed to being in a geographic area where there's not, where the ratio wasn't quite as low as high as it is in urban centers?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, they would have to be both low income and be receiving services in either a dental professional shortage area or in one of the facilities that's listed on page 3, starting on line 2. And those include a senior center, a hospital long-term care facility, adult foster home, residential care. The list is long. Those start on line page 3, line 2, and they go through page 3, line 12. So it's an and. They have to, you know, they have to meet those first three criteria and be receiving services in one of these centers, or they have to live in a dental health professional shortage area. This is not designed at this point in time to allow, you know, a dramatic expansion of those that are eligible for services. Okay. It's really about targeting a very specific, vulnerable, underserved population.
Okay. Thank you. Follow up. Thank you. What is the current, it's listed, there's 703 dental hygienists in Alaska. Certainly in some areas there's a shortage. If the advanced practice license was available, do you foresee hygienists that are working in a dental office, where I assume they all are now, would they leave to become advanced practice? Would that exacerbate a shortage? I don't know if there's a shortage. I know there's a shortage in a lot of other medical professions like nursing. And so maybe you could first speak, is there a shortage, and would this draw people away and spread a limited supply thinner?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, there is a shortage of access to dental health care in Alaska, particularly in these underserved populations. That's absolutely true. I don't think that this creating the advanced practice permit will exacerbate that shortage. In fact, I think that it would help to redistribute access to dental health, you know, dental hygiene care, which is really important, because what we have right now is a lot of the places where advanced practice permits that are as proposed here, where those providers would go to provide services, those folks are not getting service. The Alaska Dental Hygiene Association estimates that of the 703 dental hygienists, that approximately 5% would probably go on to, you know, explore an advanced practice license in order to practice independently, and that's about on par with what we've seen with nurses. There's about 5.5% of total nurses in the state of Alaska are advanced practice nurses, and so I think that I don't think it would change. It won't change the total number of hygienists in the state of Alaska, and therefore we'll still continue to have a shortage. But it might sort of help reallocate the resource that we have and get it to the people that need it most.
Okay.
Yeah. Follow up.
Thank you. So, and maybe this is a question for the person on the line, or you partially answered it as well. So if 5%, that would be about 35 hygienists, and the current population might go into advanced practice. The model would typically be they would leave the office that they're in and go serve underserved areas, whether it's in prisons or various facilities that are listed. Mm-hmm. And that would probably be their main occupation at that point. They wouldn't do that a couple days a week and then work in someone's office a couple days a week. And I just didn't know what was foreseen and I know it hasn't happened, but maybe in other states would be a model to what the outcome might be.
Representative, well, perhaps we want to bring in Ms. Virgin.
Yes, did you hear that question, Ms. Virgin?
Yes, I did. Hi, Representative Hull. This is Katrina Virgin for the record, through the chair. To answer your question, so it's very common, including myself. I work for Native Health Services and also the military and private practice. So it's very common for registered dental hygienists, not only in the state of Alaska, but in many other states, to maybe work part-time in a private practice and part-time in a public health facility or clinic. And especially so just because somebody has the advanced practice permit in the state of Alaska doesn't mean that they're going to have their own
practice.
Is she still on? Ms. Virgin, did you maybe hit mute?
Can you hear me?
Now we can. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, I apologize. I'm in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's fairly rural here. So up to what point did you hear what I had to say?
I think you were about to say practice.
Have their own
practice.
Okay. So, yeah, just to clarify, it's not uncommon for a hygienist to work in several facilities within a week. So I do not foresee, and talking to hygienists all throughout the state that have surveyed in or provide responses, the goal wouldn't be to just work in one area for one location, but it would be possibly to, say, fly out to a rural village under possibly a grant that we could get through public health services or something else. That would allow us to provide maybe for a weekend or every other month in different areas such as these rural villages or locations where access to care is a major challenge, but then during the regular week to be able to provide, treatment to our private practice patients. It also would provide the ability to be able to go into certain schools that have a certain percentage of patients that are underserved, the ability to do like sealants to help prevent decay from occurring in the first place. So it just opens up a lot more doors and opportunities to be a little bit more flexible in what we're able to do and what services we're able to provide these areas that do have lack of access to care.
Thank you. One last question.
Follow up.
Thank you. And thank you for that answer. Is there a dental hygienist program currently in Alaska?
Representative,
yes.
Wool, through the chair, there is
through
one.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, Katrina Virgin for the record. Yes, there is. We have University of Alaska Anchorage, and it is a four-year degree program now. And a lot of the program, obviously it's a CODA-accredited dental program, and they also focus a lot on public health initiatives to going out to these different areas and providing treatment. Obviously, we don't have the advanced practice permit bill as of yet, but it's something that we're hoping will continually be developed within the university program so that we can make sure that there is more equal access to care throughout our state.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any more questions. As I said, at this time, I'm setting House Bill 127 aside, and thank you very much for the presentation.
very much.
Next, I'd like to bring up House Bill 159, an act relating to repayment conditions for the medical education program participants before the committee. I'd like to invite Representative Christ Thompson and staff Kevin McGowan to the table. And could you please put yourself on the record and begin with your bill presentation? I'd also like to say that we have Stephanie Butler, who's Executive Director of Alaska Commission of Post-Secondary Education, and Suzanne Allen from the WAMI program online.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. House Bill 159 is a relatively simple bill, mechanically speaking. And for the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, representative in rural Southeast Alaska. House Bill 159 increases the repayment by a WAMI alum if that alum does not return to Alaska from 50% to 100%. So in effect, and Mr. McGowan can correct me if I'm stating this wrong, if an Alaskan goes through the WAMI program and only people who can go through the WAMI program are Alaskans, and that person goes through medical school and residency, but doesn't ultimately come back to Alaska. Right now, that individual would pay 50% of the difference between what out-of-state tuition at University of Washington Medical School is, which is what they would normally pay if the WAMI program didn't exist, because they'd be an out-of-state student at University of Washington, and the amount the state is sort of putting in to support and incent our young people to go to medical school and come back and practice here. That is the essence of House Bill 159.
Are there any questions? Representative Tilton?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. Do we have an idea of the number of people who have gone through the WAMI program who may not have come back to Alaska to practice in the past, for what we're trying to correct? And I know that, you know, the idea behind the program is that we want people to be educated and then come back and practice here in our state. So is there any idea of how many may have not done that? And the other question I would have is, what is the determination of your residency after you complete the program?
Representative Tilton, through the chair, to the first of those two questions, I believe we know exactly the number that have come back and have not come back, and I'll defer to Mr. McGowan for the statistics and also on the specific definition of residency.
Yeah, for the record, Kevin McGowan, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. Right now, we have a percentage, and that typical percentage is about 40% of students do not return to state. People that complete the program don't return to state. We have Dr. Suzanne Allen from WAMI on the line to clarify anything on that. And then,
this is Suzanne Allen. Or would you like me to
please
speak up right now about that? Or
yes, please.
So currently, we have between 14 and 15 out of the 20 students every year that we get a physician back. If we look specifically at just Alaskans, that number is a little bit lower, maybe in the 12 to 13 range, as we do have other WAMI students from the other four states who come and practice in Alaska.
To address the question about residency, one must be a resident for 2 years before being allowed into the WAMI program.
Follow up. And so then what would make a determination whether somebody was practicing in Alaska after they've completed their studies.
Through the chair, Rep. Tilton. So a student must practice for 3 years in a rural community after completing the program, or 5 years in an urban community to qualify. And so they do not do that, and they say move to Maine instead of practicing 3 years in a rural community or 5 years in an urban community, they would not qualify.
Follow up?
No, thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly appreciate the intent and the purpose behind this particular bill, and I see myself at least at this point supporting it. However, my question is there been any, and I'm not sure how you could calculate, but has there been any consideration of if we were to implement this bill, would it change the initial, for lack of a better term, talent pool that applies to the particular program, and would it potentially have an opposite effect? Because if I'm just thinking about myself, you know, starting a career, if I see the potential of getting 100% payback, and then I start to go through the program, I'm trying to think, would there be a calculation that says, geez, you know, they're going to charge me 100% if I don't go to Alaska? Would that have any impact on the talent pool, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, good question. I think this sort of speaks to the sort of all the considerations one should balance in considering this program. I'll speak, I mean, both from, you know, the perspective of the legislature and the money we, the legislature, have invested in WAMI, which, by the way, I think is an excellent investment, and it's a really sterling program. I also have literally dozens of friends that have gone through the WAMI program. Two of my closest friends in Sitka are in the process of applying for WAMI. So I feel like I have a fairly close to the ground perspective of peers who are considering this program or actively going through the program. Given that currently there's a 50% repayment mechanism on the books, I've actually never heard that cited in a conversation with a friend going through WAMI or contemplating WAMI as a disincentive for applying. I think it's also worth keeping in mind the relative prestige of University of Washington Medical School. It's one of the best medical schools in the country. It's extremely hard to get into if you're just a regular non-resident, and there's this sort of golden brick path for Alaskans through the WAMI program for these set-aside spots in an otherwise highly sought-after program. That is a consideration that I think weighs heavily with a lot of applicants, because they can get into one of the nation's best medical schools through this sort of specific program, the specific pipeline, in a way that is really appealing to them. So that's a non-financial consideration per se, but I can say that from peers I've spoken with, that sort of weighs heavily with them. And I've actually raised this bill with some of my friends who are in the process of applying, and I don't want to out anybody, but I mean, one of them related that the fact that it's not 100% presently seems like, oh, wow, like that doesn't make sense to me per se from the outset. Like, you know, the state is investing in me as a future physician. Like, it makes sense if I don't come back that I would pay what any other out-of-state student at University of Washington would pay. But I want to speak directly to your question. I think, like, yes, if 50% goes to 100%, that's not a like completely neutral effect. There might be a dissuasive effect for some applicants. I just, given conversations and sort of taking the big picture on the relative prestige of University of Washington Medical School, I think it will be a relatively small factor, or that's my assumption in this legislation.
Thank you.
And I was remiss in not saying that we've been joined by Representative Knopp and Representative Josephson. Are there Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are scholarships commonly given out for medical school?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, yes, I've had friends go through medical school, not UW, but other medical schools, and they get merit and other scholarships. Although, if your question relates to whether WAMI students can get scholarships on top of the in-state tuition that they get through WAMI, I actually don't know the answer to that. I would defer to Dr. Allen.
Follow up.
Representative, through the chair, yes, Alaska WAMI students are eligible to receive scholarships, and in fact, we have some scholarships that are specific to Alaska WAMI students. And then there are other general scholarships that they're eligible for as well. So they do receive scholarships as well as federal grants and then loans to help them cover their cost of tuition and living expenses during their 4 years of medical school.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these scholarships based on need or are they based on academic academics or both?
Yes, Representative, through the chair. These are largely need-based. However, we do have some that are academically based. I do not know the breakdown off the top of my head between the two.
Follow up? Thank you.
Follow up.
So I guess I maybe my question is similar to Rep. Ortiz's, which is if a student gets accepted and is weighing different options, maybe they got into more than one school, and they may have gotten a scholarship either from WAMI or somewhere else, I guess that would weigh into their decision. And the payback percentage, depending on whether they return to Alaska or not, and maybe you don't know the answer, I guess that would be weighed against their overall decision, because right now if they do not come back to Alaska, they're on the hook for 50%, and if this bill passes, it would be 100%. So these kind of financial questions, I don't know how often they, I guess if you're looking at 20 students per year and four students don't come back, which seems like a relatively small number, but I guess you wouldn't want that number to increase due to this payback percentage. Is that fair to I guess I'm just sort of stating the obvious here. I'm just sort of working it through in my brain, but yeah.
If I may, Representative Wohl, through the chair. Yes, I mean, I think maybe part of what your question or comment identifies is that there's the possibility of behavior change. I mean, I should speak to the fiscal impact of this. Perhaps appropriate given the conversation about the broader fiscal situation in our body recently. And this is a piece of legislation that will have a negative impact on the budget. It's part of the reason why I've pursued it. And on the order of $250,000 per year, but it's worth noting that that number assumes no behavior change. That is that in the future, the exact same percentage of WAMI alums come back to Alaska or fail to come back to Alaska after passage of this bill than before passage of this bill. If passage of this bill proves to be an incentive for a greater percentage of WAMI alums to come back to Alaska to practice medicine, then the negative fiscal impact of the bill will be eroded. Instead of 600 odd thousand, it might be 500 or 400,000 a year. So that's just to say, I mean, I think it's hard to predict exactly what the behavior change catalyzed by this bill would be. There probably would be some. In a certain sense for Alaska, that would be perhaps a positive if a greater percentage of WAMI alums came back to practice medicine. But there also, you know, I think it would be unreasonable to think there would be zero behavior change on the front end, as this would, you know, rejigger med school applicants' decisions and saying like, oh, I got into WAMI, but maybe I also got into med school X or med school Y. And depending on what the financial aid packages they have for those schools are, what the overall tuition cost is for those schools. You know, they'll have to make a choice, and they'd be making a slightly different choice with passage of this bill than without passage of this bill.
A follow-up.
Thank you. So, in a way, if this incentive or disincentive is successful, let's just say it's completely successful, then of the 20 students per year that go or graduate, they'd all come back, and then the state would have to fully reimburse all of them. They wouldn't get any reimbursement from the students, so it actually costs the state more money, but you'd have more practicing physicians in the state, and that's ultimately the goal, correct?
Representative, well, it's an interesting scenario. So if 20 of 20 WAMI alums came back, I mean, we've talked through this with Ledge Finance to get a sense of, like, what the fiscal projections are with 100% repayment. I mean, I think what you're saying is, like, oh, there's actually, like, a crossover point where if there's 100% retention, I guess, of alums in Alaska, there actually might be, like, a positive fiscal impact. I mean, I think it's worth flagging that, at least in our conversations with WAMI program, it's really unlikely we ever get to 100% because, a big reason some people don't come back is they, you know, marry somebody from Idaho or whatever, and so they're going to be in Idaho. So I think it is probably a hypothetical question, but I don't know where that crossover point is, and I'm not sure we've run through that with Ledge Phi, but we can.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I think it should be a very brief sectional.
Right. For the record, Kevin McGowan, staff rep Chris Tompkins. Section 1 of the bill amends AS 1443-510A, and it increases the repayment from 50% to 100% plus interest for students that do not come back to the state after completing the WAMI program. Section 2 of the bill is an effective date. It applies to students who enter the agreement on or after the effective date of this act.
Thank you. And I don't see any other questions. So at this time, we'll be setting aside HB 159. And you have a question?
I have a comment, if I may, Madam Chair. Just to put on the record, and I think this is just important for the committee's reference, this bill partly came about, I've long been a big WAMI supporter and I've seen the value of it to the state. I think part of the goal of this legislation is to make a structural change that is projected to lessen the pressure on the operating budget in the long term. And, you know, if there's positive externalities like a greater retention of physicians in Alaska, all the better. But sort of part and parcel with that, I think, as we all remember, the WAMI program was at one point slated for gubernatorial veto last year. And so this bill partly came about from the governor's former chief of staff and myself talking about, you know, sort of structural change that could basically just, like, put this program in a safe place for decades and decades and, you know, takes a bullseye off from the legislature, reduces the budget impact, and, like, is this a compromise that, you know, could feel good and put the program in a stable long-term place? And through conversations with a lot of the stakeholders, and a lot of credit to WAMI as well, we got there, and there have been conversations with the other body too. So I just wanted to sort of put that context for the origin of this bill as sort of a result of compromise to put the position in a good long-term place with less budget impact.
Okay, thank you. And as I said, we will this time set HB 159 aside, and we're going to take a brief at ease to change the PowerPoint. call the meeting back to order. Next, we'll have House Bill 182, an act relating to testing of sexual assault examination kits and providing for effective date before the committee. Representative Tarr and her staff, Carla Hart, are at the table. So please put yourself on the record and begin with your bill and PowerPoint presentation. I'd also like to say that David Canaris, Chief of Forensic Laboratories, is online.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Representative Garen Tarr. I'm the House District 19 representative.
My name is Carla Hart. I'm staff to Representative Tarr.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to present today. And at any point, if we're like getting too far along in the time, just please let me know. I'll try to be mindful of that. And I think the presentation won't take too much time. So this House Bill 182, just to put it in the context where we started back in 2014, I had received something from an organization called the Joyful Heart Foundation, and some of you may have also received mail from them. This organization was founded by Mariska Hargitay. She's the actress from the, CSI, the Special Victims Unit. Thank you. She's the person from that show. And what happened during her time as an actress on that show, she started to receive a lot of letters from individuals who were survivors of sexual assault and, you know, felt like, what can I do with this? And so she's turned that into this effort, this the Joyful Heart Foundation, and specifically their End the Backlog campaign. And so that's what got me started in this work. And they have these six pillars, and I just want to sort of show what we've accomplished so far, because I think it's something that we can all feel good about as we're trying to make long-lasting systemic change here in Alaska. And really, I don't see my role as sort of, you know, the sponsor of this bill, yes, but at this point, I feel like I'm more facilitating a process that we're all a part of, because this is something that impacts every single one of our districts and the potential to impact every single one of our constituents. So there are six pillars: annual statewide inventory, the mandatory testing of the backlog kits, mandatory testing of new kits, statewide tracking system, victims' right to notice, and funding for reform. So where are we? I mentioned that I started working on this in 2014. The first piece of this work was the statewide audit. That was necessary because the federal government has put some funds into this effort through the Department of Justice, and their requirement was first to create the statewide audit. That statewide audit was how we learned that there were about 3,400 untested rape kits in the state of Alaska. And that early work also led to the audit of the crime lab, where we found some other deficiencies and have been able to, outside of legislation, improve the process. And I'm excited that Mr. Canaris is on the phone, because he's doing an amazing job, and I think people are going to be really feel positively about what they hear is happening and his work that's happening at the crime lab. We continued that work. Some of the changes that were made working with the crime lab include making sure that each rape kit has a unique identifier so that there's a chain of custody. Surprisingly, you know, you order something maybe of not much importance at all, and you could track it from, you know, its location on the other side of the world till when you receive it. But rape kits that were this very important piece of evidence had no tracking at all. And so all of the kits were prepared in Anchorage, and they were sent out to the more than 200 law enforcement agencies across the state of Alaska, but with no unique identifier. So we could never tell, once that rape kit left the office in Anchorage, whether it was used, unused, sitting on a shelf somewhere, really problematic. So one big improvement was that tracking system. Continuing on with some of the other legislation we have passed, we have accomplished almost everything on this list. We did put funding in for the mandatory testing of the backlog kits. We also made a policy change to say that all of the kits will be stored at the crime lab, and funding put in high capacity shelving for that. We have made it mandatory through the legislation we passed last year, included in House Bill 49, that all new kits are going to be tested, and right now they have to be tested within 1 year. The statewide tracking system I just mentioned, and then we also did put in a victim's right to notice. Ours looks a little bit different than what they would ultimately like. They would like to have a website that an individual can log in with a unique identifier and be able to follow the progress of their kit from when it's collected to when it gets sent to the crime lab for testing to when the results get to the prosecutor's office and then on and on. What we have right now is that all kits will be sent to the crime lab within 30 days. All will be tested in within 1 year, and then within 2 weeks, the individual will be notified. Eventually, I would hope we can get to the more sophisticated type of tracking system so that the individuals can do it themselves. And one of the reasons that's really important is that an individual is re-traumatized every time they have to tell the story. And so if they have to continually call law enforcement over a long period of time and tell the story over and over and over, then that can be a very negative experience for that individual. But I think we've done something really good in at least getting that victim notification piece in there. And so that brings us to where we are today with House Bill 182 to shorten the timeline. And the reason the 60 days is in here, and I think Mr. Carneris can speak to this, is that we have discussed what's the best case scenario, what is the best that we could do in terms of turnaround. And Mr. Carneris thinks that 60 days is probably the best that we can get to. And I'll let him speak to the research he did of what other states are doing, but you'll get a sense of why 60 days should be a goal we could achieve. But where we are today is that we think the achievable next step for now is 6 months. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in terms of what it means on the training side of things, but just want to focus in on the timing of the testing, because I think there's no need to talk about how horrific sexual assault is, but this is specifically about shortening the time for the testing when the kits are collected. And this story, I just think we all need to just sort of take a moment and take it in because of the significance to so many Alaskans who were injured through this. And this Mr. Mosley, he was allowed to be on the streets prior to his arrest, and it was talked about in the article that the delay in testing his rape kit allowed for this fourth woman to be raped. And this is the part I think is really important for us to all sort of take in. The effect on the victims cannot be overstated. Some of these women waited years to find out who their assailant was. One woman moved back to her hometown out of fear and shame. One of these women, after years of suffering from infertility, despite her best efforts with her partner, became pregnant as a result of the rape. The cruel irony of carrying the child of a rapist after years of trying to have a child with her partner had a significant impact on her. For each of these women, they relived the trauma of the rape and recently endured having to tell a grand jury what happened to them. But we may have prevented some of those things from happening if we had done things in a more timely fashion. And that's why the timing really matters. This is just one story. As I've worked on this issue over a number of years here in the legislature, but the more than 20 years I've lived in Alaska, I've heard too many awful, awful stories. And now that people know I work on these issues, I get a lot of people reaching out, and the trauma, it does not go away. It really does not go away. I've had people collapse into my arms into tears about something that happened 40, 50, 60 years ago. And so I remember those things, and I think we can do better. So this bill would be the six-month step. And I just want to talk a little bit about sort of the resources necessary, and that's reflected in the fiscal note. But one of the things I've learned through working on this is even if we put the funding available on July 1, it will take a number of months for the job announcement to go out. It'll probably take a number of months for the right individual to be found. These are technical positions, and it's not as if we have a number of people in Alaska waiting to be hired. And to compound that, because there's been a national effort on this issue, there's a lot of demand for these professionals. So I know Mr. Canaris can tell the story of finding a good applicant only to lose them to another job opportunity. So just the time it takes to bring those people on, get them trained, I think it may be in the bill packet. If you look at Mr. Canaris' list of specialized training, it is extensive. So in addition to having the scientific background, because this is evidence, you need to have the background checks, you need to have the FBI training, you need to have the chain of custody training, you need to be fully pulled into that world so that you're fully qualified for that, and it just takes some time. So you'll notice that the fiscal note reflects that as well as the effective date for this, recognizing it's gonna take some time to have them be able to staff up, get the people trained, and then be compliant with the law should we pass this. But here's one thing I think we can all feel really, really good about. when we talked, and I want to let Mr. Canaris talk a little bit more about this, about whether we could get to 60 days right now in this first step, he said what he thinks is that it's possible that if we get the resources in this bill that will get us to the 6 months, once they get up everyone fully trained and caught back up, that they will not need additional resources to make it to the 60 days. Now, that, you know, of course may evolve over time, but I just think that's a moment we can all feel really good about, because we know when this crime lab was built that we didn't sort of fully staff it up. But now, over these number of years, little by little, we're getting the people in place. And this won't be good just for the processing for rape kits. This will be good for all processing, because it'll build capacity among their staff to do this work. So the 2020 goal is to get the bill with the 6 months, continue working with the crime lab on the goal of 60 days, but giving them the time they need to get those professionals in place. And in my handoff to Mr. Carneris here, that's all I would like to say for today. But in my handoff to him, I just want to compliment again the great work he's been doing at the crime lab, and the work he's done outside of, you know, this legislation to learn what other states are doing. And I think he can speak specifically in the context of the Finance Committee of the return on investment in investing these dollars into this kind of work. Thank you so much.
Does he also have part of the PowerPoint, or is he?
He does not. This last bit, and I guess, Madam Chair, I could play it right now, and then we could hand it off to him. This is the I Am Evidence movie trailer. It's just a couple of minutes, but it also sort of speaks to the timing, which is what this bill is all about. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Canaris, would you like to add to Representative Tarr's presentation?
Thank you. For the record, my name is David Canaris. I'm the Chief of Forensic Laboratories with the Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Lab and the Department of Public Safety. And thank you, Representative Tarr. I just wanted to add that the positions we are asking for can move us in the right direction of getting these backlogs reduced. Currently, we have around a 9-month backlog when it comes to sexual assault kits, which we all recognize is not where we would like to be with testing these kits. There are a number of studies have been done nationally as to what the benefit is to testing these kits. One was published in 2019. The title of the paper is The Jurisdictional Return on Investment from Processing the Backlog of Untested Sexual Assault Kits. I'm not an economist myself, so in reading this paper, I'm trying to have to go over it and put it in terms that I understand, but to the best of my ability to understand this paper, This paper looks at all the different factors which go into testing these kits and then the benefits. So they look at the benefits in terms of a resolution to the assaults, in terms of the benefits to the survivors, benefits to the prevention of repeated assaults from serial rapists, prevention of societal costs external to the people who are directly victimized. So those are costs on friends and family and preventative measures around those costs. The upshot of it is that they think that there is around somewhere between a 9,000 and 64,000% return on investment for each sex assault kit processed. The disparity in those numbers really depends on the number of kits you're processing. So a large lab, a large testing facility, one that's testing tens of thousands of kits per year, obviously the cost per kit is a lot less for those facilities. We're on the lower end of that spectrum, so that if this paper is correct, then the return on investment for Alaska is likely to be more in the 9,000 to 10,000% range. So we're estimating it's costing around $1,500. I don't have a firm number on that. That's a number I'm really trying to get, but the national average is kind of $1,400 to $1,600 per kit. So if we're in that ballpark region, and I've no reason to believe we're not, we're looking at a 8,000 to 10,000% return on investment for each kit we process, which is very significant. Mm. What we've also seen is a large uptick in the number of submissions to the lab. So if we go back to 2012, there were 303 DNA submissions to the lab across all case types, not just sexual assaults. We're talking property crimes, violent crimes, homicides, everything. Last year, we had 651, so doubled in those 7 years. And this year, we're forecasting over 800 cases coming in. Around 60% of those will be sexual assault, so over 500 sexual assault cases. The reason for this, we think, is there's been a 34% increase in violent crime rates in Alaska between 2013 and 2017. I haven't seen the most recent data on that to see if that trend has continued. There's also a significant amount of national attention on the sexual backlog, and now it's become at the forefront of these policy reforms. There's also the issue that DNA has become this forensic panacea, and so as people are more aware of the potential of DNA and what a remarkable technology it is, more agencies are submitting more items and more evidence into. So there's a huge effect on increasing those amount of cases we get in. So we're asking for two positions to get us to that 6 months, which, as Rep. Tarr says, that is the next step that we would look to get to.
Thank you. Are there any questions before we go to the sectional analysis? I don't see any. Next, we'll do the sectional.
Thank you. For the record, this is Carla Hart, staff to Representative Tarr. We didn't prepare a formal sectional analysis because there's two sections. One changes it from 1 year to 6 months, and the second section puts the effective date at 2021.
Excellent sectional analysis. Would they all be this easy? Are there any questions? For the sponsor or staff, Representative Josephson.
One question and one comment through the chair. Representative Tarr, your work on this has been heroic, and my support for this bill is virtually guaranteed. I mean, as much as a committee person can say that, you can count on it. Is the reason why this law can be met because it says the agency shall ensure, and is the reason we think we can achieve that because we're going to privatize until these two new people come online? And now we have the testimony of the chief of the evidence lab saying that we can meet this goal. So we're comfortable with that language.
Through the chair, to Representative Josephson, yes, it is true that they think they'll have to outsource for a portion of the time to meet that deadline, but then they'll be in the process of staffing up and cycling in. And perhaps even that could happen more quickly, but just to be realistic, watching what we've done over the last couple of years.
Just a comment, if I may. So from my time as a prosecutor, Madam Co-Chair, typically a serious sexual assault or even a less serious sexual assault would not come to disposition in a six-month window. And why this is valuable is you can narrow, people are entitled to their defense, but you can narrow those arguments. If the defendant sees that you have undeniable evidence, it's going to change the nature of their defense. And you can sort of cut to the chase and get these things resolved. Because a lot of these cases will go a year, 2 years, could be 3 years before you go to trial. And this will should speed that up, and I think that's why you see this return on investment. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add, one of the other things that is going to be really helpful about this is that it's going to change our understanding of who is involved with these crimes, who's perpetrating these crimes, who the victims are, and to the extent that the prevention work we do is based on what we've learned, you know, it gives us, I think, a whole new opportunity to look at prevention work and, you know, maybe get to the place where we're actually preventing these things from happening instead of responding when they do happen. Thank you.
Representative Wall.
And thank you, Representative Tarr. We've heard this bill in other committees, so it's good to hear it again with a different timeline. Looking at the numbers of the 2017 inventory of 3,484, the 2019 of 1,696. So if I understand this right, as Representative Josephson said, you've outsourced a lot of these, or all of these, or a great number have been outsourced to reduce the backlog. When the backlog's eliminated, what is the incoming number of kits obviously too high? Is that make it more manageable when you're not dealing with the backlog? In other words, what is the staffing that we have or would have would be adequate? And maybe that's what you're speaking to on the 60-day part. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Wohl, just to separate those two things, the backlog were all of the untested kits when we started doing this work and did the audit back in 2015. Those ones have been cataloged. They've been prioritized by, for a number of reasons. There's a whole committee that worked on this, but, and they're being sent out in batches. So those ones that the funding we put in the capital budget a couple years ago is covering the backlogged. Then this is talking about the new ones as they come in and the timeline for that. And to meet the deadline for this, there's a period of time where they would have to send some of them out as they're getting the new staff trained up. So a little bit of both, but specifically for the backlog, those ones are definitely being sent out to outside. We're trying to get staffed up for in-state processing for everything that's new.
Thank you for the explanation.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair to Representative Tarr, do all the kits, once they're tested, does that information go into CODIS or a like database?
Through the chair to Representative Merrick, yes. And if I could ask Mr. Canaris to talk about that a little bit, I think you would like to hear a little bit more of how he could describe it, if that's okay.
Yeah, follow up real quick for that. And if he could maybe let me know, you know, I know they're doing some genealogical testing, you know, where you might not find somebody in CODIS, but you might find somebody, a relative somehow, and how that's determined if they further that particular investigation.
Mr. Canaris, did you hear the question?
Yes, Representative Merrick through the chair. So the first part of the question was, do all of the samples that generate a positive profile end up in CODIS? And the answer to that is yes, everyone that's eligible. And so CODIS is strictly governed by the FBI. There are certain eligibility requirements for which samples can go in and can't go in. So to make it eligible, a crime has to have been committed. So we have to do a little bit of checking, and we work with law enforcement agencies to make sure that each sample is eligible. But if it's eligible, it goes into CODIS, yes, and then it can be checked against further cases and such like. The second part to your question was about genealogy, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And that was that's not something we currently do here at the crime lab. That is, again, outsourced. Those cases are very labor intensive, and it's not a skill set that we currently have access to. So that's more of an investigative decision. The law enforcement agency We'll send the samples here for testing. We'll test those samples. If it doesn't generate a hit against a profile in CODIS, they would make a decision in concert with us, and we would provide some kind of technical expertise in explaining what that means and the steps they would have to go about doing it, but that work is not currently done here at the crime lab.
Thank you, and thank you for your great work you're doing there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? At this point, then, we'll be setting House Bill 182 aside.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So the agenda for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2020 at 9 a.m., we'll be doing House Bill 121, which is a repeal state agency performance audits, and House Bill 209, established Department of Management and Budget. We'd like to have amendments for House Bill 186, which is the naming the Irene Weber Bridge, due Wednesday, March 4th at noon. And do members have anything they'd like to bring up before we adjourn? Okay. This meeting then will be adjourned at 3:54 p.m. Thank you.